Chapter 19. That night, Mara came to him in a dream. Miller felt guilty, since he'd been thinking of her as he tottered off to bed, long after the mini-toasts with his new friends, long after he showed them a few of his martial arts tricks, long, long after the great fire had died down to a bed of dull red coals. He remembered thinking, as Mara finally led him off to show him the guest hut, that she really was a fine-looking person, especially for a druid. And the guilt had stung twice as hard, since he was still thinking about Yuki. And anyway, making love to Mara would be like sleeping with a nun, wouldn't it? Because she wore that robe and... And anyway, she had just clapped him on the shoulder and shoved him in the door, where he'd found a pallet of clean grass and a beautiful wool blanket waiting for him. And he'd lain awake for just a few minutes, amused at first at the thought that this was two nights in a row that he'd been up drinking, and he almost never drank back home. Home. Where was home now? When was it? Would he ever see it again? It wasn't perfect, but it was his life. Could he possibly get it back? It didn't seem likely, but then nothing that had happened to him in the last 2 weeks seemed likely if you looked at it. Maybe there was still a chance, without a way to get anywhere, except his legs. Without a map, without, for God's sake, any faint notion of where he was supposed to go or what he was supposed to do when he got there. He glanced at his watch. The numerals glowed faintly. 64 hours, 17 minutes. On top of everything else, there wasn't any time to do all the things he didn't know how to do. And so, it was not a terribly happy Tony Miller who finally sank into sleep. He didn't know how long he'd been asleep before the dream came to him, but it was very clear and not at all illogical like so many dreams. Mara's face swam in front of him, and he felt guilty because he wanted to see the rest of her. Maybe without that bulky robe? And she seemed to know that from the understanding smile she gave to him. And she leaned close to him, her moist lips parting softly. And she spoke.
38, 123,
Mara said.
Home, sweet home.
She reached a hand down toward his face, and he closed his eyes, anticipating the caress. Miller sat bolt upright on his pallet. He was panting. A thin coat of sweat had formed on his forehead, and he felt a chill in the air. Around him, the snores of other men echoed off the walls. In the distance, a dog barked, and someone was retching.
38, 123.
Miller never for a second questioned that it meant something. But what? What the hell did it mean? And why had Mara appeared in a dream to tell him? His breath was slowing a little now, and he made an effort to shake off the nightmare feeling, the sense of unbearable urgency that the dream had left him. And why should that be? It was just Mara telling him some numbers. Why the perception that it was so vitally, earth-shakingly important? The only thing he could think of with that kind of urgency to it was as good as over. The business of locating Bodhi headquarters within... Miller looked at his watch. 62 and a half hours. And then it was all over, no matter what. That was not the only number that mattered. 62 and a half. Not some nonsense from a dream. He needed to get a grip. Clearly, it was no more than an anxiety dream, like the one he'd had his first year of teaching at Berkeley, where he'd been halfway through his favorite lecture in front of the huge freshman intro to anthro class and looked down to discover he wasn't wearing any pants. Reflexively, he felt for his pants. He was still wearing them. But the small lump of artifact was missing from the pocket. Miller felt a stab of panic, but he fought it down. It was just a rock at this point. It didn't matter. Still, he felt the loss. Very deeply. Puzzled by this, he rubbed his neck and realized the necklace Yuki had made him was gone too. What was happening? Was he really being robbed? Here in a Celtic village? From what he knew of the culture, that was unthinkable. But the two items were missing. How? It was possible that somebody had taken them while he slept, but as far as he knew, only Mara had been close enough to him. Mara. The dream came back to him. It had been so compelling, as if she had really been there, almost as if he had really opened his eyes from sleep and seen her standing over him. So real, and it now seemed so important. What had she been trying to tell him? What had the dream meant? Miller shook his head. What was he thinking? It was pure anxiety. Mara had been in the dream because he'd fallen asleep thinking of her, and the numbers were random. They meant nothing. They had just been generated by... By what? Did dreams generate random numbers or images? He didn't think so. Usually, they didn't create anything. They only combined what was already there. Burbling away in the subconscious. Why should he have numbers in his subconscious? He was an anthropologist, not a mathematician, not a number-oriented person at all. That's why he always forgot things like his own telephone number or zip code. Why he'd forgotten the numbers Cook had blurted out to him, the coordinates to Bodhi headquarters that...
Time stopped.
Not the way it had when the artifact stopped it. No, this time it was purely subjective. Time stopped only in his head. Miller held his breath and tried to stop the furious pounding of his heart, concentrating on nothing but his breath, his heartbeat. It worked, and Miller let out the breath.
38, 1, 23.
The coordinates. The location of Bodhi headquarters. It had to be. The subconscious never forgot. It had been trying to kick the numbers back upstairs into this conscious mind and chose Mara to deliver the message. It sounded right. It felt like the numbers Cook had blurted out to him. For no logical reason, he was sure they were the right coordinates. And so what? Where in the world was 38123? He didn't have any idea whatsoever. Not even an idea of how to find out. He was in, what, 3rd century Northern Europe? They didn't even have maps, let alone latitude and longitude. Having the numbers was no help if he didn't know what they meant, where they were telling him to go. And the dream had given him no hints at all about...
Home, sweet home.
All right, Miller, he told himself. If you're going to believe in messages from dreams, let's go all the way. The numbers that came from your dreams really are the coordinates of the Bodhi headquarters. Fine. So, home sweet home clearly had to mean something too, right? No problem.
What? Well, all right, it could mean Mara's home, which meant he was there, at the right place, which meant the Bodhis were a bunch of 3rd century Celts. Nope. Or it could mean his home, either where he was born or where he now lived, in Berkeley. Berkeley? Was it possible? Miller closed his eyes and thought hard. A few years back, the university had made a film to show to prospective students. They'd done a clip of his graduate seminar on the evening. He discussed the cultural context of hula dancing. He jokingly referred to it as the swimsuit issue of the seminar. Only slightly embarrassed, he'd gone to see the film when it was finished. It had begun with a huge flourish of music and then a voiceover. An important-sounding announcer had droned on about the campus, located in the San Francisco Bay Area, along the 38th parallel, with a few well-chosen and interesting examples of other things on that same parallel.
Home, sweet home.
Could it be? Were they really located in Berkeley? His Berkeley? Miller thought about it. If there was one place on Earth where a cult would not be disturbed or even noticed, it was California. Within a stone's throw of the campus, there were a number of ashrams, spiritual retreats, New Age think tanks, holistic centers, everything from spiritualism and Buddhism to UFO worshippers. Yes, it could be. It definitely could. It made sense. Miller lurched up off his pallet and ran for the door. If Mara objected to the uproar when Miller stood at the door to her hut and called out in the early hours of the morning, she did not show it. One of the warriors present had barred his way, but backed off and stood at a distance with the others when he saw it was all right with her. After all, Miller realized, he was a hero, and he had a strange and powerful weapon. And anyway, if the healer didn't mind, it was all right. The hard part for Miller was thinking of a way to communicate to Mara what he needed. He'd said Pax to the warrior at the plane, and that had worked. The Celts had some contact with the Romans, he knew. Perhaps it was the way to go with Mara. He was certainly better with Latin than Celtic.
Marum,
he said. He made wave motions with his hand to indicate the meaning. See. She pointed to herself and lifted an eyebrow.
Mara?
She asked.
No. Marum,
he said.
Marum. Ocean. Sea. Water. Aqua?
She shook her head and said something in a voice still rough from sleep. Whatever the exact words, it was clear she wasn't getting what he was trying to say. He tried again.
Marum. Mar. Mare. Ah, damn it. Large body of water,
he said, trying as many hand gestures as he could think up.
A place where there are boats. Boat. I need a boat. Ship. Bark. Brig. Sailboat.
The word coracle came into his head. He knew it was descended from the Welsh word for that kind of small round boat the northern Celts had favored. He shrugged and tried the word.
Coracle. No, by God, cura,
he said as he remembered the Gaelic. Mara cocked her head.
Coracle?
she said, cupping her hands together to make a small rounded boat with a pointed prow. She rocked her hands to show the boat on the ocean.
Yes,
Miller exulted.
Kurgle, by God, Kurgle! Boat!
In his excitement, he took her hand and she smiled and pulled it away.
Kurgle,
she said. She pointed to the sky, mimed the sun coming up. Then she took his hand and made the two fingers of her other hand walk. The meaning was clear. In the morning, I will take you there. Miller stood, gently lifting her up with him.
Now?
He said, pointing at his watch to show urgency. But of course that meant nothing to her. He hopped on one foot, then the other, like a child who had to pee.
Now?
He repeated, pulling her toward the gate. She studied her for a moment. After all, the dangers of night travel were plentiful, especially with unknown enemies out there, like the samurai. Miller tried as hard as he could to pantomime urgency. Now, let's go. And Mara finally nodded. She held out the palm of her hand, indicating he must wait a moment, and went back into her hut. And now Miller really was almost hopping on one foot in his anxiety. The idea of a boat offered such a slender chance to begin with that it was almost better to simply relax and live out his life as a hero among the Celts. But it offered a tiny chance, and he had to take it. He had reason that, if samurai and Celt could be side by side, there must be some lump of future thrown into the mixture somewhere too. And if that proved true, there might, just might, be something at the seaport fast enough to get him to the coordinates in time. When Mara came out again, she was dressed for traveling, with her dark, hooded robe and a heavy shoulder bag. She beckoned and led Miller toward the gate. The warrior who had stepped forward before now appeared at Mara's elbow, and the other warriors closed in. Mara glanced at them, and was met with a look of such fierce determination that she merely smiled and bowed her head. It was clear that the men of the Opida were taking no more chances with the safety of their healer. End of chapter.